Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room is Jim Oines speaking on the Sanctuary Movement, a model for active justice. So let's listen in on Jim.
I was just telling Martin earlier that I thought maybe what I could do then today is I find that this is something that I've learned through the sanctuary work, is that I find that stories can carry more information and connect in more places to people than sort of what you might call a systematic or way of. I find the stories are very systematic in a way. In other words, what I like to do is tell you a little bit about my own story, which is what I did yesterday, and then talk a little bit about what I've learned as a model for organizing for justice through this sanctuary thing, and some of the things that I learned through the process. But I think it might not be very understandable if I don't tell you a little bit of the story. And it's also very, very easy to get into arguing over principles when we don't know the context, you know. So let me just start a little bit and give you a little bit. The story is, it begins a long time ago, which was when I went with three friends on a bicycle trip from Detroit, Michigan to La Paz, Bolivia. And in that bicycle trip, I went through with these friends all the way through Mexico and through all the countries of Central America and ended up in Bolivia. And that's where I learned Spanish and also went through Guatemala and El Salvador, of course, at that time. Then I went back, went to seminary to finish my last year. Then served at the Two Point Parish in South Dakota, Armour and Corsica. And was there for 3 years, but felt like I wasn't really using all my skills, felt that it was a pastorate that many other people were prepared to do. And so then I received a call to Arizona Lutheran Church in Phoenix and took that call. It was in an area where the community had changed a lot. It was mostly Norwegians, Germans, and Swedes in the church, but the neighborhood was mostly Hispanic. And the church, and most of the sort of typical Lutherans had moved to the suburbs, and we all know that scenario of what's happening so much in the cities. Come on in, have a chair.
I thought he was the man I wanted to talk to.
Oh, okay.
He said his office is upstairs.
Did you want to talk to who? Martin?
He talked over there this morning.
Oh.
Well, what we're going to talk to him about is...
John Peterson, I bet.
Okay, is he?
Yeah, he's upstairs.
What do you do?
You just go up that stairs and kind of go straight into the office area.
Oh, okay, thank you.
So anyway, I moved there in 1979, and one day, I think it was the last of the years, October of 79, one day in 1980, a man came into the church and he said, I don't have anything to eat, I don't know where to live, I don't know what to do, and we were talking in Spanish, because I learned Spanish on this bicycle trip. And I said, well, what part of Mexico are you from? I'm not from Mexico, I'm from El Salvador. And I said, well, what town are you from? And he said, Santa Ana. And of course, Santa Ana came up in my mind. I rode my bike right through Santa Ana. So I'm just trying to illustrate how experience also makes for a connection between people and kind of opens your heart. So we talked a little more, and we worked on finding him a place to stay and things like that, and resolved that. In the meantime, then a little bit later, I got to know a family of Salvadorans who had come to the United States and who were uh, trying to help other refugees that would come. And so then every once in a while, they would call me and they would say, Jose Martin just got arrested by the INS, that's the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and he's being held in such and such a detention center. What are we going to do? And so we did different things, like we would try to raise their bond money. They used to have a bond of $2,000 to $5,000. And so we would try to get that money and together and get them out of jail. And his family was very insistent, and I had also been doing some talking and discussion with people that many of these people, if they were sent back, would be killed. And so we started working on a number of cases. And I'll just give you an example of one young man that we worked with who we were able to get him out of detention by paying his bond. Then he came up for what's called a political asylum hearing. Well, this young man had been working in a labor union in El Salvador. And one day, the Hacienda police, that's called the Treasury police, came to his house. They took him, and they wanted to know from him who some of the other organizers in the labor union were. And they took a bag, they filled it with lime, they put it on his head, and they tied it shut and beat him with a baseball bat. That's called, it's a common torture device used around the world. It's called capucha in Spanish. And then they let him go, which was also, sometimes they would just kill people, sometimes, and oftentimes the death squads would kill people and leave some kind of note on them, which said, indicated to others that if you join this labor union, if you do this, this is what will happen to you. These death squads were organized by the military and involved in killing. By the time the war ended, and there's still some of it going on, about 75,000 people have been killed in El Salvador, and most of them, now most really good research has shown that 80 to 90% of those people were killed by the military, the U.S. government-backed military. Anyway, this young man, they let him go, and they often did that too, because they wanted people out there saying, this is what they did to me. And because it's hard for us to imagine, but it's called government by terror.
And in our country, we call it the chilling effect.
Yeah.
On the first, in your First Amendment rights, if you want to send a message to somebody, you control what they say by scaring them, and then sending the scared person out to scare other people.
Yeah. Anyway, he left, and he came to the United States, but was... This young man's story, I think, is different than any of the others that I talked to, because he was a two-time survivor. But anyway, what happened, he got to the United States, immediately he got picked up by the Immigration Service and deported back without even a hearing, because he was confused about what to do. We found that this was the case with so many refugees, is that refugees, we would say, had some rights, but they didn't know what they were. And one of the things that's very interesting that most U.S. citizens don't know is that for people from other countries, undocumented people, the government is not required to provide a lawyer. So these people, if they are not in some place where they know somebody, which is, of course, if you're a refugee, how are you going to know somebody? Really don't have access to the information they need to defend themselves. And this young man signed what the INS called a voluntary departure form, but he had no one to tell him that he had any other options, which were few anyway. So he was deported back to El Salvador. And then he was arrested again. And this time when he was arrested, he was able to escape, but he was shot while he escaped. But he did get away. And He got back to the United States, and this is then when, after he was arrested by the INS. By this time, his family had, his sister was in the United States, and she contacted us when he got arrested. And so then we went and raised a bond to get him out of jail, because he wasn't going to sign, he finally blew it up not to sign the voluntary departure form. Got him out of jail, got him a lawyer. He, through a long process, just to make a long story short, finally got a hearing with the judge. The judge, after looking at the bullet holes, said to him, "How do I know you didn't get this scar fighting in a bar?" And so he was deported again. He did find it, and he came back. Yeah, came back to the United States. Third time, he lives in the United States. He finally did, and I'll tell you a little bit about the story of why he got protection finally in the long run. And so we have, this is, I just tell you his story as an example of many stories, common, very common. This judge that deported Carlos, his name is Judge Nail, is notorious for never having granted a political asylum. And he was the one that they situated down along the border because the INS knew that this is what he would be like and what he would do. And almost all immigration judges at that time, in the early 80s, were almost like him. Once in a while, one would grant a political asylum, once or twice. Actually, the political asylum process, in a way, was also very moot because of what was happening to most refugees to not even get to into the process because of their not having anyone to explain to them what their rights were and what they could do. I began to meet so many of these people and try to deal with raising money, finding housing, all these things. And then I started to talk to some other pastors that were sort of in the inner city of Phoenix and some other people who lived there. And they were having similar experiences. And so we organized an ecumenical group. We called ours, in our city, the Valley Religious Task Force on Central America. And we started to talk about ways that we could protect refugees. And we came up with our idea in Phoenix. We talked about the idea of sanctuary city. And we actually approached the INS and we said, if you will release Salvadorans to us, we will find them housing and we will find them a lawyer to bring them through the political asylum process. And we did that. But then we discovered that they were only releasing to us those refugees that we knew about. In other words, people that had someone that could contact us from the detention centers, and that they were at the same time deporting many more people than we knew about. And a common thing for the INS to do was to find jails that they would rent from little county jail places out in different parts of Arizona, California, notorious places, El Centro, California, which is very removed from any, from very much legal services, and that's where a lot of people were housed, but also smaller places they would house. And they would constantly move them. As soon as human rights or church groups could situate a lawyer there, then they would stop putting people there and put them somewhere else. And all kinds of things like that went on over and over again. And so at one time, the U.S. government was deporting about 400 refugees per month from El Salvador.
Supporting the corrupt regime at the same time.
Yeah, and sending money. At that time, too, we were sending about $1 million a day to the government of El Salvador. So people were really trapped. People, if they left El Salvador, came to the U.S., and in Mexico, generally, they couldn't find in Mexico to get a job or anything because of the poverty. You need to have a family connection. And so people really did not, although many people stayed in Mexico in very destitute situations, most of them tried to come to the United States But then we get picked up here and then we're sent back to El Salvador. So then during this process, then similar things were happening in cities all along the border and even some farther north. And the process farther north was somewhat different because the huge numbers of people being dealt with wasn't as great, except for possibly San Francisco. And so then, and we had been doing a lot of discussion with some of us that were working in Phoenix. We're talking a lot with some people in Tucson, the pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church, John Fife, Jim Corbett, a leader in the Quaker community there, some other people. And we had started to talk about the idea of sanctuary. And then one day, and this little church, Southside Presbyterian, did a Bible study over 3 or 4 weeks a month on what is the concept of sanctuary. And they looked at the different places in the Bible, they looked at sanctuary city ideas, they looked at passages like Leviticus, which says, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, do them no harm, for you are once strangers in the land of Egypt. They looked at things like Hebrews that says that give hospitality to strangers because some people from doing that have entertained angels. And they looked at all the whole idea and then started to see, which a lot of us were seeing, that this whole idea of sanctuary is really a big idea, that it has, that in some ways Israel looked upon its land that it was going into as a sanctuary for its people. All kinds of things. Started to see it all over the Bible. And then one day, so then what they did is when they told the press that they were going to give protection to refugees who didn't have papers. And they called a press conference. They had somebody, a refugee that was covered with a mask. And this refugee then, in front of the TV cameras, in front of the world, you might say, publicly said, I do not have documents. Here's why I left my country. Here's why I don't feel safe in applying for political asylum here. I'm afraid I'll be deported if I do it. And then the people, the pastor of the church and some of the members and some of the other people from the community, like the Quaker community, said, and we are going to help this person and we're going to protect them. And the clear statement then was, we are willing to put our lives on the line with this person. We're willing to risk. And constantly always saying, we're not risking near as much as this person is risking and all that he has risked or all that he's lost. And to not make the North Americans so much the heroes, because they really weren't. It was the South Lawrence who were willing to speak, who were really risking their lives. And so then, as soon as they did this, people all over the country started declaring sanctuary and doing this because people were searching. Because we had been doing a lot of what would be called silent sanctuary, a quiet sanctuary. And we were helping people, but we weren't doing anything that would really change the policy. And because we were just keeping quiet about it. And so this whole idea of public sanctuary was what really changed the whole thing, that all over people started in different ways, maybe not just like they did at Southside, different ways announcing, being very clear to the public what they were doing. And so a lot of these things were learned from, for example, Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., who learned most of that from Jesus. And it's called nonviolent direct action. And it's a way of organizing where you're very clear and open and honest about what you're doing, and that you feel like there is something either wrong with the culture or the laws that are causing people to suffer. That it's not just something one person is doing wrong. It's not just something that is because a particular person over there has made a mistake, but that there's a whole system somehow that is really hurting and destroying people. And so we talked about what this is. Would we call this civil disobedience? And we wanted to call it that because there's a long tradition of civil disobedience. Gandhi would see a law that the British had, and for example, the law that said Indian people had to work in certain kinds of jobs but could not go above a certain job or whatever. And then, so the Indian people were issued a sort of type passport type thing from the British government, from the people who were occupying that country. And the British government was defining them for them. So Gandhi organized a nonviolent direct action where he and a whole bunch of other people burned this passport, and it was against the law to burn the passport. And they did it in public. You maybe remember the movie. And the British officers came and beat on the people and when they tried to burn them. You remember that when they beat up Gandhi for doing that, and he has to crawl to be able to throw his burning passport in the basket. So the idea, we thought, well, this is civil disobedience. But then we started to look at the law, and paradoxically enough, just when most of the refugees started coming, the U.S. government had signed the 1967 Protocol on Refugees by making it part of the 1980 Refugee Act, which says that if a person flees persecution for reasons of race, religion, membership in a particular social group, and a couple other categories, they shall not be deported. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to become a citizen of this country, but that they shall not be deported, like our government is doing to 400 people a month. So we looked at that law and we said to ourselves, now what is wrong here? Is the law bad? Or is it actually that our government is breaking the law? And so should we really be calling this civil disobedience? Are we sending the wrong signal here? Not that civil disobedience is a bad idea and it is not a good word for some times, but we thought maybe we could find a better word. And so we noticed that Judge Jackson in the Nuremberg trials came up with a word, and he said that by the time the Nazi regime rolled around in Germany, there were already some laws in the Geneva Conventions. And there were clear laws that said that a person does not have the obligation to obey an unjust law. This is still a conflict way up to our day, and a social you're a lawyer, I think you would agree that most lawyers in our country, don't agree with that concept. But anyway, he said that the German people, when people were fleeing the Nazi regime, should have taken civilian initiative and caused their government to obey the Geneva Conventions. That they should have initiated obedience to a law, to international law, which he said takes priority over national laws. Judge Jackson, one of the head judges in the Nuremberg trials.
Yes, absolutely.
He said that they should have initiated obedience because there was a conflict. At that time, it was a little bit different because the national laws of Germany said, yes, you have to turn in Jews. If you find a Jew, you have to turn in to the government. So they had actually written laws that said you could do that. But he went farther. He said even if a law says that you need to is ordering you to do something that's unhumanitarian, you need to initiate obedience to the higher law, which you call the international law. And so we tried for a while, and I don't know if we got much press on that, but we talked a lot about either civilian initiative, or sometimes we call it civil initiative. And I think it's a discussion that needs to go on. Because I've seen it occur in other places. There are Israeli army soldiers who have called on civilian initiative and have said, we will not enter a Palestinian town and do some of the things that we're ordered to do. And so there are Israeli, not officers so much as soldiers, that are in jail because they've refused to do some things. There are other occasions around the world where people have cited this idea. So anyway, one of the things that we try to deal with, and now maybe I'll move in a little bit to some of the things that I've learned from this, is that we had to really be about both discussion and action. A sort of model that I learned, and some of you probably learned before too, that I think helped me continue on through making a lot of mistakes, was this model that Paulo Freire probably made known the best as an educational model, called the action-reflection model, which is that social groups, when they find themselves in a situation that does not seem right or just, can use this model. And he talked mostly about the poor in Brazil. And the model is that what you do is you never consider that you have solved all the problems at once. That what has to happen is you need a balance or more better set of dialectic between action and reflection. That you may start with action, you may start with reflection, but you get your group together, you talk about what you think needs to be done, then you act, and you do something, and then you get back together and you say, okay, what happened now that we acted? And what is the situation now that we acted? Has it changed? Did we do the right thing, or did we make a big mistake? How should we proceed now that we look at this, and what always happened to us was that once we acted, the whole situation is different. And we had to go back and say, boy, here's some things that I didn't know. And we had to say, you know, here are some models people have used before. And we would say, you know, here's what Martin Luther King Jr. You know, we tried things early on, like we tried this taking people to the judge and asking the judge to give justice. And then when the judge didn't give justice, what we could have said was, well, there's nothing else can be done. But what we did is get back together and say, do judges always give justice? And maybe there's a different kind of justice. And so that, I found, really sustained me to not have to think that everything we did has to have to be completely successful.
Or perfect.
Yeah, or perfect. Or that maybe the mistakes helped us learn. Or maybe they weren't even mistakes, and we would like to call them mistakes, but it was a mistake because we acted. At least we did something.
What it does for me, Jim, is it takes your whole movement out of a sort of ideological fixation that there is only one truth and you possess it, and you're going to march right through your realities based on your vision of truth alone. What this does is you act in courage, but then you step back and say, did we do the right thing? Or would there be a better way to do this? Or what have we learned in the meantime? It can also, I suppose, be an occasion for repentance. Mm-hmm. We did more harm than good this time. So rather than keeping you sort of ideologically fixated that you have one vision of truth and you're going to pursue it, it's one step and then a reflection on It's a very healthy.
This, I just, the way it gets drawn sometimes is the way I put it up here, is that it's also a wonderful model for education, this interactive model, where people begin to discover their gifts and powers. I am very convinced that in the United States, we for a long time have, I would even go farther and say that we've been involved in what's called maybe an idealistic model. I think we even have more trouble with idealism than ideology. Because we have what we would call a very successful country, but I think we have many people who feel unsuccessful. And we set up this model that if you act and it works, then you're a great person. If it doesn't work, there's something wrong with you. And so we set up this ideal success model, and so that really sets us up for all being weak and helpless. We feel weak and helpless even though we maybe have a lot of money, we maybe, we still feel, you know. And so anyway, this is, but can you imagine how you would feel if you were in Brazil and you were in the slums? If we feel weak and helpless, how do you imagine if folks like that feel? And Paulo Freire actually applied this model, educational model, in Brazil, and it worked. I think it's a good one. But
did Gloria just step up and volunteer part-time?
Yeah, we had a number. We found that even with volunteer lawyers, though, that it was overwhelming. That the process to defend one refugee, even if you had 10 lawyers, took so long. The courts took so long that this was one of the elements that was involved is this giant bureaucracy, the INS, that just had an overwhelming advantage, and that they were set and they were in place to deport people. And all the groups along the country were not set. They were not in place. They were not ready. And they did not have 500 lawyers that you need to do, you know, if you have 500 people.
In the same connection, do those discussions with those other lawyers of the immigration deal with that, what you call the law, these conventions of Geneva and so forth that our country has signed, that this is a binding law for them? Is that the point that you try to get at? Or?
We tried that. What I was going to do is sort of list.
Maybe you'll come to that later.
Yeah. Well, I'll jump over to that. A lot of people, as I was telling Dale yesterday, 18 people were indicted in Arizona and New Mexico for helping refugees, and they were accused of smuggling illegal aliens. And then we went to court, and we had a judge who said, and our lawyers said, we want to discuss who's breaking the law. Is it the government or is it these people? And the judge said, you can't discuss that. And they said, we want to talk about the 1980 Refugee Act, which is part of the law, not even just a protocol anymore. It was signed into law by the president. And he said, no, you cannot talk about that law. I said, well, we'd like to talk about international law then. No, you cannot talk about international law in this court.
So he ruled that out?
He ruled. He had a list, and I forget how long, it was a whole page of laws that could not be discussed in a trial.
Yesterday and today again sort of blows my mind. From your law background, how can a judge do that? How can a judge say, there are laws that we can, and then in trying this case, there's laws we're going to ignore?
Well, the theory is that you've got to draw a circle somewhere and say what's inside the circle is relevant and what's outside the circle is irrelevant. The theory being that the law is a seamless web, that's acknowledged, but if in every situation where you're trying a person for a discrete crime, you allow the entire corpus of the law to be brought in, you simply never get anywhere, because then every single action against a person becomes a philosophical conversation about sovereignty, in essence, which law obtains. And I think what they're doing in a situation like this is simply limiting the range of the conversation to a certain level. Now, lower level courts do that all the time. It's only going through the appellate system when you get to the upper levels of the appeals court in the federal system and the U.S. Supreme Court, where the conversation philosophically can range as broadly as you want, because you're trying to get to the right result. You're not just basing it.
Eventually, they're the only one who could decide this agreement.
Yeah. So it's a cumbersome.
Yeah. What we figured out about the government in this situation then is that, as I was saying yesterday, that the government deals with lawsuits every day. The U.S. government brings cases against people every day and also gets sued every day. So the Attorney General and mostly all the people who work for the Attorney General, and we were dealing with federal issues here, federal crimes, they said. The U.S. government in no situation has figured out that if they want to bring this case, for example, against these 18 sanctuary workers, that they can probably tie this up long enough so that even if it gets all the way to the Supreme Court, they will already have accomplished what they want to accomplish. And by that time, the issue that's being dealt with at that time, which is really was a political, social, governmental issue, will be moot. And that's what this huge bureaucracy, one of the things that this huge bureaucracy has figured out, is that they have time on their side. And that they can bring a case, even if it's an unjust case, against people if they want to make a political point or they want to kill a movement. And that was what they were betting on.
And then in the meanwhile, you provide sanctuary, then they indict you or whatever group is that.
Yeah, and they also, this has become very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. I was not indicted, but I was an unnamed co-conspirator in the indictment. They talked about our church, and then they said, unnamed co-conspirator, pastor, oh, that was always the church. This is some people that had worked a lot of organizing in the 60s told me that this has been a well-refined art of actually writing indictments in ways that will really scare people. So that you indict some people, other people you do not want the publicity of indicting them, but you want to scare them. So that has been done. How much of this I'm fantasizing about or others are fantasizing about, I can't know. But this is one theory. Some of the things that we are sure about, though, is that they did bring an indictment. I was getting at your question, and I think I got lost.
I have two questions.
What was your first one?
Well, the first one had to do with when you come before the judge. What do you appeal to? The Geneva Convention? Mm-hmm. And those things, I think that's the one I asked first. Mm-hmm. As something that the United States has accepted and is therefore a law. Or what do you appeal to?
What we did is, maybe what I should do is, finally what ended up happening, not so much because any one person was doing all this thinking, but because we were talking to each other. And here's what ended up happening, is we ended up, not me and any one person, we ended up working on many, many levels. And what I did is I sat down this morning and I wrote some of the levels that we worked on. One of the levels was we worked on the level of protecting people, just direct protection. Another level we worked on is we went around to churches and social organizations and we educated people by letting refugees talk to people. and let them tell people what they were doing. Another level we worked on is we talked with each other, people that had quite a bit of an experience by now, and we said, we feel that the government is breaking the law. Let's bring our own lawsuit. So we organized and we brought a lawsuit called the American Baptist Churches versus Ed Meeks. And it was a civil suit claiming that the United States government was breaking the law. And it was called American Baptist Churches because there were lots of churches listed, but A comes first in the alphabet. So that came to be called American Baptist Churches. And so that lawsuit was going on. And the government was hearing very clearly, we're willing even to bring a lawsuit. They were hearing. That was, at one level, it was working through the judges. At the other level, it was working as a message to the government. We're not going to back down. And then we were working at, and this was the important piece that I think Martin Luther King Jr. discovered and others discovered earlier on, was the media level, is through the refugees being in front of the camera, speaking, telling their story, people seeing that the pastors, Catholic sisters, were willing to take them into their homes, was then making an impression in the public. And then this whole risk of people being at risk. We were working at the level where we would go around and actually recruit lawyers to voluntarily defend refugees. The ones that were arrested had to be defended. There's the only way, unless we were going to get an army and raid the detention centers. I mean, it's the only way to defend the ones that were arrested. And so those are just some of the levels that we realized that we had to work at. And that our society is indeed a process. It's not just the legal system. It's not just a media system. It's not just people gathering in churches. Our society consists of all these things, and that if we were going to get anywhere, we had to work at all these levels, which sounds extremely daunting. And it would be if only a few people were doing it. But if there's some trust that others, and in your conversation, some people are going to say, well, here's the level we can work at. So people in denominational levels were willing to put their name to a lawsuit against Ed Meeks, where what they sometimes were not willing to take people into their homes. You know, and so people had many roles at many levels and
from different places.
And we found that, and if you look back on the civil rights movement, I think you'd find that the same thing happened.
There were a lot of people contributing money to the effort who would never want their names publicly associated with it.
Yeah.
It gave them different ways of buying into the whole process.
Well, their local members, you support someone who's full of views, you know, yourself have, but you support him in what he's doing.
But you did this in a very conservative state. What did you just get people all upset? How did they react to it?
Well, Arizona's a funny state. It's the majority of the people are conservative, probably in background. But there are a couple other things. That there are a number of people that moved there because they like the desert. They like the place, and they really have a lot of political sophistication and have been involved in other movements. And in an interesting way, it made it maybe a little bit easier to work because it seemed like we kind of felt like we were this group of people who were pretty easily identified with each other. Yeah, one level that worked. The other level that operated, there were just a lot of good-hearted people who said, this is not right. These people, we know that it's true. After they hear somebody speak, they tell their story. If I get deported, I'll be killed. And they tell, and it's becoming more and more obvious. They hear 3, 4, 5 people tell the story. The notes, pretty soon they start to believe it's not a lie. They would simply say, I don't know all the philosophy, I don't know all the theory, but it seems to me that this person's life is valuable. One of the things that I started to deal with and try to understand is why sometimes the opposite could happen, is why people could be confronted with another human being who is obvious their life is in danger and not be able to respond with any kind of compassion or action, which is probably more common than responding with compassion and action. And I started to realize that it's some partly because of what happens in our own hearts. We become callous, we become sinful. But we need to take sin apart and describe it. You know, how is this sin operating? And one of the major levels at which it operates in our society is what's called propaganda. And one of the interesting things that was going on is that I would go, for example, I called up newspaper reporters and said to them, there are these people here who, if they get deported, I'm sure they're going to be killed, or they run a great risk of being killed. Don't you think you would like to write a story on this? And they would say, well, has this been over the AP wire? And they really did not feel like they could write a story on this unless it had come over the AP wire. Here's a local reporter who is, for some reason, so benighted. Here they have, from the other point of view, the opportunity for a Pulitzer Prize to write a breaking story, and they say, has it come over the AP wire? This just blew me away that somebody would say this. But then I began to realize that most news media people are some of the most isolated people in our society. That they really live in a rarefied atmosphere and live in under a deadline atmosphere, and that most of what they write about are what they are assigned to write about and do not have much decision-making power over what to do. And of course it was even more of a struggle because in Phoenix we have two newspapers that are housed in the same building that are run by the same company, which is run by the Republican Party. So of course, I mean, Ronald Reagan had run on an anti-communist ticket. And his, of course, theory was that, and he even ran, he made a speech like this during his campaign, is he said, if we don't do something about the communists in Nicaragua, they're going to organize, they're going to come up through Mexico, and they're going to attack the United States. And people voted for him for that, and he said other things about why we need to fight communism. And then when he got elected, I like to say he closed his eyes and he pointed to a place, pointed to the map where he needed to stop communism, and he looked and he said, what's the name of that country? Oh, El Salvador, that's going to be the place. And in some ways, it was a perfect opportunity because the guerrillas were well organized in El Salvador. Base community groups, all those have created a real threat to the Salvadoran government. And here was his place to stop communism. Well, then with all the death squad activity, I think that all of this got away from them, and they, in their zealousness, really were not able to actually see what they were doing. They were not able to know just how corrupt and corrupting that whole nexus of the system between the money in the United States and sending guns and helicopters and stuff had become. And so they were willing to turn away when the death squads would massacre a whole village like El Soledad or something. And so then, but what that made is that when people came here to say, no, we're not being killed by the guerrillas. It's not the guerrillas that are killing most of our people. It's the army. It's the military. They have to say, no, this is not true. The reason people are coming is that they're economic refugees. And so people, there was this double bind, and we found what was happening is what this well-refined thing called the big lie, which is that you say something in the largest channels of media, and even if people don't hear a person say something else, they are so, all of us are so controlled by what we've heard through the large sources of information that we cannot respond quickly enough to change our mind. So I went and I started reading about theories of propaganda. And Jacques Ellul, who just died, he was a French Protestant, did a study and came out, he became quite pessimistic about industrial society because he feels that both the Eastern Bloc countries, and then he wrote it before the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the West runs on propaganda. That our societies are so large that we actually, I don't think he uses the word, but I would use it, are addicted to propaganda. Our economies are addicted to it because we have such large systems that we need to keep running. And the ways that we keep that running is through telling people that this is how they need to act. A good example is McDonald's. McDonald's is not the best food for us. It's not really all that great of an environment for eating with your family. It doesn't really support the family system much, but we all eat there. Even those of us who don't agree with it, we go there and eat there. And they're able to do that because they're sophisticated systems. And he said propaganda works at every level. And I said, well, that's not true. That can't be. But then you think, you go out and you see somebody wears a T-shirt that says McDonald's. You turn on the radio, and a song about McDonald's. You drive down the street, you see McDonald's arches. You know, and it's on and on and on. And the government, on occasion, is able to do that too. And so that's why any movement needs to also realize that if it's going to be effective in any way, it needs to work at many levels. And how we get out of the situation where we run on propaganda is a whole other discussion, and I haven't gotten too far on that. And Jacques Ellul became very pessimistic about it himself. He wondered if we are going to find a way out of that.
Just a comment, I've been in the Palestinian problem in local areas of Tacoma, and some of my Jewish friends have kind of almost given up the political opposition to the powers that be, and also there's a fight within the Jewish community that is given up fighting against the majority of the hack groups and simply saying we've got to start with small things and we've got to join them, and, which is rather surprising. It's a different tack. In a way, it's doing what you said on this paper here, that you really examine what you're doing and saying, well, we're not getting anywhere, and then you come along and do the opposite. I guess the other thing that, as you talk, it seems to me that right now, with the way Clinton is handling the refugee Cuba, and the way, and that's kind of main line, would be the way in which people in California, the governor, and other people are handling the same thing. So it seems.
Yeah, we're in a very different situation. Maybe tomorrow we can talk.
Opposition to it. Might not be politically effective, yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, right now there's what a lot of people, I have a lot of friends, and made a lot of friends in the different refugee organizations around the country, people working in this immigration and refugee service, like for example John Fredrickson, who is in charge of the recent office in Washington, D.C. He's in charge of the office that LIRS has there. And he's just very depressed because there's such an anti-immigration fervor in the United States right now. And so he feels so alone because he seems like, he feels like he can't get anywhere in Congress. He can't, you know, with people. It's hard for him now to bring up, man, these people, it's hard for him to say, well, these people are going to die if we don't do something. And they come back with, you know, well, but my constituency is opposed to.
Well, we're in a frightening time in this country where we do not believe, we think we have a very limited pie to dig up.
Yeah.
And if we let other folk in, our slice of that pie will be smaller. And if we have folks who are being laid off by the thousands from our major industries as we make the transition from an industrial society to an information society, then we've got to help them first. That they're just, I mean, we're not in an expansive mood in this country. We're in a very conservative, threatened kind of mode right now until the world order begins to shift and we can turn in an optimistic way again. But it's not an optimistic time. And as long as it's not optimistic, we just don't think we can handle any more problems than we already have.
Well, you know, Florida really can't handle any more problems than it has in Texas and California. But what, aren't we using that communist ploy again? I mean, what would be so terrible about lifting that embargo and letting these people...
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is that we need to realize is that we can no longer go on believing that we're not a part of the rest of the world. Which is, what, see, we talk about this on one side, we'll say we can't receive any more immigrants, but then we will continue to support a system where United Brands, which is United, used to be your United Fruit Company, owns 40% of Honduras, pays people at the most $4 a day to harvest bananas, which are sent up here that we, so I tried to raise a garden in Phoenix and I couldn't afford to raise a garden because food is so cheap in the United States that I could not even, it made more sense for me to go down to the grocery store to buy food. It was cheaper for me to do that than to put the water on the garden. To raise them. And the reason for that is because we pay the people that harvest so much of the crops in the world do not get paid what they deserve. If we would simply change that, if people would get in a third world or what they call now the two-thirds world, would get paid what they're worth.
Well, look what we're doing.
They wouldn't have to come here.
In our own country.
Yeah. They wouldn't have to come here.
People cannot. We know many young couples in congregations there in the Midwest that cannot subsist on farming alone.
Right.
The wife has to go out and get another job in the community, or sometimes even the husband goes out and gets another job in the community so that they can make it go.
The rest of us who go to a store cannot believe that a box of wheat checks costs $4.25. So there's
money.
Confusion.
And
where's the money? If it's not going to the farmers, where's it going that I have to pay $4.25 for what must be able to be
mass
produced?
Look at how many different kinds of cereal we have to have in the grocery store nowadays.
It's the people in between.
People have choices.
One last comment too. Lily Wu just wrote. I'll bring it tomorrow. Lily Wu does information for this Immigration Right Refugee Service, and she said, and she's just a really dedicated Christian, and she's part of this little Lutheran church in New York City, and she teaches Sunday school, and she said one day this little girl came and said, Miss Wu, I can't come back to Sunday school next Sunday, and she said, well, how come? And this little girl is 12. She says, because my mom says now I'm old enough and I need to help her in the factory. And people can't believe, and it's true, there are sweatshops all over in the United States as well, that people work for, and these are immigrants, that people work for, like, it costs them, they get paid like $4 to make the dress, and it sells for $75. And it's like this. Thank you.